Hello and welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek Discovery podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, and somebody owes me a beer.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and the craziest thing's been happening to me lately. I wake up every morning and there's a cup of coffee ready and waiting for me, and I thought my roommate was just being really sweet, but I figured it out this week. It's me. It's future me going back in time and making myself coffee.
That's exactly what I would do with a time travel suit. just bring previous versions of me coffee when I know I most need it.
Right? I'm really smart.
That would actually change the outcome of a lot of my days, to be honest.
Yep, that's how I've been moderately successful in anything I've ever done. Time travel and coffee.
Well, together with Ode Beers and Time Traveling Coffee, we run a speakeasy in the Jeffries Tubes.
And today we are talking about the season 2 finale. Didn't love the name, felt like a little bit of a cop-out, Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2, which was written by Michelle Paradise, Jenny Lumet, and Alex Kurtzman, and was directed by Elatunde Onsunsanmi.
Yeah, I can't believe that we're already here. We are at the finale, last episode of this season. Obviously, we are going to have a lot to talk about in this episode, and of course, we'll have our wrap-up episode as well, where we'll talk about the season as a whole, and we'll make some predictions, which is going to be hard to not do. It's going to be hard to try not to make a lot of predictions in this episode, but we will save all of that for next week. But before we get into any of that, and even before we get into our announcements, I want to say a few words about the great science fiction writer Gene Wolfe, who passed away this week at age 87. I think people are well aware that Gene Wolfe was very important to me, and his work always will be. I discovered Wolfe when I was in the Army. I read his most famous fantasy series, The Book of the New Sun, but it was, I think, really in the years after the Army that he became, a part of my life in the way that writers and artists do. And for me, getting out of the Army and going home again was very tough. I'm not the only person with that type of story. And this was something that Wolfe went through as well when he came home from the Korean War. And his story, The Island of Dr. Death, and other stories really helped me get through some of the roughest bits of that. And this was really also for me a time, I guess this was around age 25 or so, these were my college years. It was also a time when I was making choices about being an adult in the world, about what kind of person I wanted to be and what role I wanted in the world. And Wolfe's series of books about a science fiction priest trying to save his community really played a big part in that for me. And Wolfe was less well known than he deserved to be because he was a writer's writer and his work never made it to screen. But he was a major influence on science fiction, really, as soon as he started writing in the 1960s. And he was a big influence even on Star Trek, especially the movie Star Trek: The Motion Picture, which is largely an uncredited adaptation of Wolfe's story, Alien Stone. So I would just like to say to listeners of this show, if you've never read any Gene Wolfe, this week is a great time to honor him and his work and his contribution to science fiction, of which Star Trek is a part, by doing that, by checking out some Wolfe. His work is widely available, but if you don't have time to read, I would like to recommend the podcast Podcastle, which has done a really great reading of his short story, The Island of Dr. Death, and other stories, which is a just genuine masterpiece.
And something that listeners of Lower Decks who don't also listen to the Gene Wolfe literary podcast might not know is that Gene Wolfe himself was a listener of Glenn's podcast on Gene Wolfe. And Glenn, I am touched by how much joy you brought to his life and how celebrated he must have felt by your interest in him and how much he meant to you. So kudos to you guys.
Yeah, I don't know how much actively Gene Wolfe was listening to the show, but I do know that he was aware of it and that it meant something to him that people were still talking about works that he wrote 50 years ago. And it really did bring me a lot of joy to be able to return to him something of what he gave me as well.
And speaking of our Lower Decks listeners, we have a little bit of an announcement with regards to all of the new Trek that is going to be coming out soon. And with all this new Trek, most of the attention right this moment has been focused on the upcoming Picard show, which will be airing this fall, in the fall of 2019. And people have been asking us here at Lower Decks whether or not we're going to be covering the show. But we would love to add the Picard show. But Lower Decks itself is a ton of work, and so it's looking right now like we might not be able to do it, even though we would love to.
Yeah, it can take me anywhere from 15 to 20 hours of work to create an episode of Lower Decks. It's way more than any of our other podcasts take. And it's totally worth that for a third of the year. I love doing the show. I love watching Discovery. And of course, I love hanging out with Valerie. But I just can't do that for another 2 or 3 months without giving up something else in my life. But we really would love to do it. And so to that end, we have made it a Patreon goal. And it's a big Patreon goal, though I think that we will easily hit that if everyone listening can support us, even just at the lowest level. And actually, if we got to that goal, we would hit a number of other goals along the way, which would be really exciting. And it would also let us upgrade our equipment, which is something that has rather plagued us behind the scenes this season. So if you're excited about the Picard show and you'd like us to cover it, please just check us out on Patreon. Of course, we're immensely grateful for the support, and we really hope we can meet that goal. And of course, meeting that goal, doing the Picard show, all of that would position us to cover the other shows in development, and especially the Pike show that I hope is really secretly in the works.
I mean, how could it not be? I mean, that's like my, I know we're not allowed to speculate right now, but like my number one prediction leaving this finale is, oh, we're going to get a Pike show.
Yes, we will wear this topic out, I think, in the wrap-up episode for sure.
Well, you know, we kind of did get a Pike show with season two anyway, so we're just being greedy. But, and in addition to all of the fun we have making this podcast for you and talking to each other, we also really love talking to you guys on the forums and how much that enriches our own reading of the show. And to carry that over to the Picard show would really be a dream.
And of course, we still don't have a definitive date for when that show is going to happen, so we don't quite know how long our hiatus is going to be. But before we get to any type of hiatus, before we get to any new shows, we've got to talk about this episode. We've got to talk about this finale. And I know we went into this episode with a lot of expectations and a lot of hopes. How did you feel about it, Valerie?
I felt like I should have made some popcorn because this was a movie.
It really was. And I think one thing we can say off the top, right, is that clearly, I mean, it's done by the same writing directing team. It was conceived of as a single story, the two-parter here. And yeah, if you just watched it uninterrupted back to back, you're looking at close to 2 hours. And yeah, it's movie length. And it felt rather cinematic, felt completely cinematic.
You know, it's not just movie length, it's movie quality, right? And I think that, you know, we make a lot of comparisons here on Lower Decks, and I do think rightly so, though, you know, there are other shows I'm sure we're neglecting to mention, to Game of Thrones. And something that Game of Thrones did to TV was kind of, you know, make TV quite cinematic. It like upped the bar for effects and storylines and all those kinds of things. And we've seen that influence, I think, here on Lower Decks. This, even just at an hour's length, with the effects and the acting quality and the complexity of the story, it felt like sitting down to watch a film. But to answer your question, you know, by, I think, which is whether or not I liked it, which is what you meant by what do you think of it, I mostly really liked it. It wasn't my favorite episode of the season. I would say it's like a 75% really enjoyed it, 25%.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I was, I think, pretty disappointed in it, not in a grumpy, cranky pants sort of way. I just thought a lot of the storytelling beats were muddled. I thought they were off. I thought our actual characters, our Star Trek Discovery characters, got lost in this episode. I think they got lost in the last third of the season. That's something we'll talk about in our wrap-up episode. So it sounds like you liked it a lot more than I did. I'm glad that we can restore that balance to the Force. Did not like when we had an episode that we both were really grumpy about.
Yeah, no, I think overall, in my eyes, while this, I don't think this was a perfect episode or, you know, the perfect story arc, I do feel like they redeemed themselves a little bit for the missteps that I was looking at earlier in the season. So I was mostly pleased. Yes.
And there are absolutely some phenomenal scenes, some heartbreaking scenes, some exciting scenes, and also some funny scenes in this episode that I'm excited to talk about. So let's get into our scene by scene. We open in the middle of battle preparations, and we are jumping around. The camera is jumping around from ship to ship, station to station, person to person, and the camera is spinning for much of this in order to convey a real sense of urgency and energy. I mean, it's literally dizzying, but in a way that I think is really exciting. And Pike says, we have one job, get Commander Burnham and Discovery through the wormhole. And then On top of that, all our characters have a really specific job to do to prepare for the battle that's about to start, right? The suit is still being assembled. The crystal is still being charged. Detmer and Number One are figuring out how far away from the battle Burnham has to get in order to open up the wormhole. And I think all of this is great because it sets us up to understand what the goal is throughout this episode and also what are the immediate obstacles that have to be overcome. I wish every story opened this way. Goals and obstacles just plainly stated.
I don't know how much I loved the dizzying effects of these initial scenes. I honestly had to rewatch the first 5 or 10 minutes of this episode 2 or 3 times because it was just a lot for me. I think that the effect that it was trying to achieve, it did successfully achieve. I felt dizzied by it. I felt frantic. I felt like it was really hard for me to keep up. So I guess I was like that guy Burnham yells at to go away because he's not doing things well enough or fast enough.
Frantic, I think, is probably the right feeling for this. It was something that I responded to positively, but I know that not all viewers will. Discovery's been doing this kind of spin camera thing in like conference meetings all season. I have found it fine. My wife has found it horribly annoying. I mean, like, she can't watch it because it actually makes her dizzy. I did like the camera work here in the opening, and actually did like all of the quick cut scenes and people yelling at each other about things. I mean, it reminded me of the army, and I liked that.
Ah, okay. So that's actually a useful piece of information. So to be clear, I didn't mind the camera work at all. I think it's been really cool. And this is, gosh, Glenn, it's going to be so hard not to talk about the whole season. But I've enjoyed the camera work throughout the season and that it's been a thread that has followed us throughout, right? That this camera work, it's not feeling like a different director is touching each episode. It really does feel like it is a part of a cohesive whole. And I think that's really cool. So I didn't mind the camera work at all. I think it was just the rapid fire yelling and cutscenes and this and that, you know, which makes sense. My job is to sit alone and a room with someone and have a thoughtful conversation, which is like the opposite of this scene.
All of us who adore TNG want that all the time, right? And it is true that this show is not that show, and certainly not this episode, which, if you know, the season's been building up to this battle really from the get-go. We get on the Discovery Bridge, we get Saru making a speech as well, but here he just quotes The Art of War. He says, "Be extremely subtle, even to the point of formlessness. Be extremely mysterious, even to the point of soundlessness." And then Georgiou finishes the quotation for him. She says, "Thereby you can be the director of your opponent's fate." And on my first watch of this, I expected that these lines were going to matter in some way, that we were going to see, I thought we were going to see our heroes being subtle, being mysterious, being silent, and even being formless somehow, you know, in key moments, and that was going to save the day. None of that happened. So I have no idea what the point of this scene was. It was not a rousing speech. It wound up not meaning anything.
Oh, man. Glenn, I could already see what's happening is that you said you didn't like this episode. I say I loved it. Now you're starting to say things you like about it, and I'm going to start saying bad things about it. So like, I think we're going to be really hard to follow. I think maybe the better way to frame this is that we both have complicated feelings about this episode. Some good, some bad, to different degrees. And I'm so nervous to say this on air to our listeners and to you. But this speech, let's call it a speech, I put that in air quotes, was the first beat in this episode of me not loving Captain Saru.
Oh, I didn't like it either. That's why I'm asking you what the point was. I didn't understand what it was for. It doesn't do any of the things I thought that it would, and it is not rousing. It didn't get me excited about watching the episode. It didn't pump me up for the battle. So it certainly couldn't have done that for the bridge crew either. And, you know, it was delivered in response to hearing that there's no way for them to get reinforcements. And so it sounded almost despondent.
Really, I really wonder what our listeners are going to think about this. But to me, it felt like Saru's in the captain's chair, like fully for the first real time. And he's asked to give a rousing speech, and he hasn't planned for this moment, and he feels a little uncomfortable, and he botches it. He's like, oh, what's a cool quote about battles that I can use right now? And I think a generous way of reading that is that this is an opportunity for us to be along for more of the ride of Saru's development as a commanding officer. So if that's what it's setting us up for, I'm all about that. I've never been in a captain's chair. I've never had to give a rousing speech. I imagine it's hard, and I would probably not do super well the first time either.
So here's what I imagine, right? If you're in a command position or potentially could be in a command position in the military, you need to have a speech like this kind of ready to go, a rousing speech ready to go. Of course, the obvious answer for all of us is to have some version of the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V. The problem is Lorca stole that from Saru already. So Saru hasn't had time to look through Shakespeare and find another one. And so all he's got is his backup passage, and it was Sun Tzu, which is probably what my backup passage is as well.
I mean, yes, he's a very erudite commanding officer. That's lovely. I don't know, Glenn. So I really appreciate your military perspective because, you know, Starfleet is a militaristic or military-esque is probably a better way of putting it, you know, organization. I also think that sometimes there's a problem with that comparison because this is Starfleet, Glenn, not the military. It is different.
It's not. They are the military. They have weapons and they have license to use them against people. They are the organization that the Federation uses to prosecute wars. They are the military.
No. You misunderstand. They love people and are nice.
Right. And of course, we have talked at length about this tension. It was a big theme in the first season. It's come up this season a little bit, too. It will come up as we do other Trek shows in the future and, of course, continue on Patreon to cover the Trek shows of yesteryear. I have never felt this tension, particularly as you can tell, but especially in Discovery. I think Discovery has actually leaned pretty hard into this is the military, the first season arc about a war. This season also filled with tons of violence. And since we will continue to talk about this forever, we can leave that topic for now. We're still on the Discovery bridge and Leland calls. Everybody hates him. They're certainly not going to just give him the sphere data. And so there's going to be a fight. Then we get a line that I thought was just, frankly, I just thought it was really dumb. It's a line about how the heroes have 200 ships and the baddies only have 30. But then Leland tells them to count again because the whole of his ship is actually made up of tiny drone ships or something. There are a lot of weak parts to this episode. We've just talked about one of them. But I think that this is really the core of everything that I thought was wrong with this episode. The writers here, maybe it's more fair to say the showrunners, they're trying to make Star Trek look more like BSG or really, I think probably Star Wars by giving us a battle between space aircraft carriers instead of space submarines, as Star Trek has always done. And what this means, the fact that we're going to have these, you know, 200 shuttles and other types of Federation vessels, and then all of these little nano hull drones, what that means is that it puts all of the storytelling emphasis on the wrong things. It's all on these little ships that aren't actually carrying any of our characters. And thus, our characters don't actually have much to do unless the writers manufacture meaningless conflicts for them. And we are going to see some of that in this episode.
Wow, I think that's a really fair criticism. I wasn't able to put my finger on it that way, though. I will tell you that I had an active dislike for these little repair robots that come out later in the episode because it just was like, I felt like I was watching Star Wars and not Star Trek. And we don't have to get into a giant debate about saying bad things about one and good things about the other. I'm just saying they're different. We go to them for different things. They have different ways of doing things. And I'm not enjoying kind of the crossover that we're getting between the two. I like my Trek to be my Trek and my Wars to be my Wars. And I didn't really appreciate that so much. But, you know, there are a couple things here that are hard to square. I'll start off by saying that I just agree with you about the line about how many ships there are and then the count again. I thought it was super cool. When he said count again, I was like on the edge of my seat. And then all the little tiny spaceships happened. And I was like, oh no, this is bad. So I was totally there for that. I really enjoyed it. But I did find myself confused as a viewer about what was happening, particularly when Pike is giving orders like Squadron 2, you do this, and Squadron 1, you do that. Because we have all these zoomed out shots of the battle. And I kept being like, oh, no, there's other Starfleet ships here. Oh, no, wait, there's not. Those are Section 31 ships, but they just look like Starfleet ships. Oh, no, wait, is Squadron run ships or is it shuttles? What are these things? And like, I found it really hard to follow precisely because this isn't how Trek does this, right? We don't ever see a battle like this in any of the Trek that takes place farther in the future than Discovery does. And I could not really make heads or tails of it. But listening to you talk also made me see a bigger flaw here, which is, you're right, it's about caring about the characters, because all the people I cared about were on the ships, which weren't the main target of anything. And you know, like, we know Spock lives, we know Pike lives through this, and the ships aren't really in danger. So I was never super worried about anybody, and that robbed me of some fun tension.
Precisely. And the Pike barking orders, you know, these sort of tactical moves, which all fell really flat because we don't know what those maneuvers are. And because, as you say, it was really quite impossible to make any visual sense of what's going on. All of that is happening because the choreography of this battle is such that phasers and photon torpedoes aren't how our ships are prosecuting this battle. It's all these little shuttles and stuff. But right, because Pike is on the bridge of the Enterprise, instead of saying, you know, target whatever with the photon torpedo or with the phaser, he's having to bark all of these maneuvers out, and they're just meaningless to us. They're not something that we can understand, and therefore we don't know the significance of them. We don't know how we're supposed to feel. And yeah, I think that's where this was the mistake, to turn this into a Star Wars or a BSG style battle, but then to retain our Star Trek structure of where the characters are supposed to be.
This is helping me make sense of a feeling that I had while I was watching, where I almost noticed myself starting to resent the people on the bridge of the Enterprise, including Pike, because I was like, who are you? You're not even in this battle. Like, your life's not even on the line. You know, you're just directing these tiny little ships. And how many of those ships that have people in them got blown up in this battle? We never get to know, right? It's just, it's dehumanized in a weird way and hard to follow. But I definitely found myself being like, what do you know, guy on the bridge barking orders? Whereas typically, one, it's like odd for me not to love Pike. And two, when we see Trek shows, when we see battles that focus on what's happening on the bridge, the captain is getting thrown every which way or knocked out or seriously injured, right? You're really in the thick of it. And there was almost this power dynamic, this hierarchy that came through because of the separation of danger that made me dislike the position of many of our favorite characters.
Well, I think that's a fantastic observation. I think I was feeling that too, though I hadn't quite articulated that. So I'm really glad to hear you say that. And, you know, the writers do try to do something about this problem. And so when we come back from the opening titles and the battle is really raging, you know, lots of people are shouting shield percentages and so on the two bridges that we're following. But then we get this call, or Pike, I should say, gets this call from Poe, who has taken a shuttle out to the Section 31 fleet, and she's discovered that they have special shielding, but that she has figured out how to beat it. And because of this, Pike puts her in charge of the fighters. And then we do see them occasionally, you know, doing some stuff, though I will say that this special shielding business never comes back in any specific way. There are no consequences to this discovery. It just gives Poe something to do since she's hanging around.
We also are set up with this Odo Poe's in danger thing, and then we completely abandon any check-ins on Poe until the very end of the episode.
Right. And she really, I think, has no business being here from a storytelling standpoint. I mean, she doesn't do anything heroic at any point, and she has no personal stake or motive in any of this. She has no arc to complete. She's not actually a part of any story that's being told here, whereas we have characters who are and then get shortchanged because we're spending minutes on her. I think all of this is just a real jumble. It's a real mess.
I'll disagree on the heroics point, because I do think going out in with a single, you know, a one person kind of, I think she's in a shuttle, a one person vehicle into the middle of this battle to find out what's going on with the shields and how to defeat them, I think that is quite a heroic act. My complaint is that I wanted to follow her heroism through the rest of the episode.
Yes, well, that's what I mean when I say doesn't do anything heroic. I'm not meaning to minimize the danger of the thing that she just did, but we don't see her do it. We're not with her when she does it. So narratively, we're not seeing anything heroic. We're not following her as she's using the cable to take out AT-ATs or you know, something like that. But I think this episode wants us to do that, but then we have to leave Poe in order to spend time with some of our characters. We have to have Pike barking these tactical orders instead of Poe doing something like that, like actively leading, you know, Red Squadron or whatever it's called here, and doing that. And so this is kind of a tired metaphor, having your cake and eating it too, but actually I think just leaving nothing but crumbs.
it's making me think about the battles from season one that were just a little bit more fun to watch as space battles, you know? And it, I couldn't even, half the time, I couldn't even figure out where Discovery was or where Enterprise was in the zoom out shots. And so I didn't even, in that sense, wasn't always clear to me that I was watching Trek because I couldn't find the Trek ships, which have like that very clear look, right?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And, you know, I don't want to just keep piling on to the choices that were made here about the choreography and the way to tell this story. Some of this actually was quite good. And I mean, one thing we should say is that the effects are awesome. It all is visually stunning and really just gorgeous to look at. And the battle continues, but the Section 31 fleet is ignoring Enterprise because Control is going to use all of these drones that it's got as kamikaze fighters to take out Discovery's shields, because getting into Discovery is really Section 31's goal, or Control's goal here. So Pike has to put Enterprise in the way, in between Discovery and these drones. And Enterprise takes a serious beating here. This looked very good. And this actually did move me. This is maybe the only part of the battle where I felt emotionally connected. And really, you know, what made me feel emotionally connected was that this action had a specific goal with specific stakes and consequences as well. And, it's a motivated move, the outcome of which actually matters to the plot and matters to the characters we're following on screen. So, you know, it gives us that hook as an audience, gives us that buy-in. All right, well, that's a lot on the battle. We've really front-loaded, I think, much of the battle discussion. But back on Discovery, the crystal is finally charged and the suit is ready. But on the way to the shuttle bay, Stamets is gravely wounded. And so Tilly and Nilsson have to take him to sick bay. And sick bay is full of people, as doctors and patients. I mean, Discovery's been taking a beating as well. I was confused by this, though, Valerie, and I'm hoping you can tell me where I have missed something, because I thought that the only people on the ship were the dozen or so friends who were going to the future with Burnham.
What a good point. I hadn't noticed. I think you're right. I don't know. I don't have an answer for you. I have a question like this for you later about, hey, can you explain this, like, what seems to be a giant plot hole to me? But yeah, Glenn, I got nothing for you. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I won't harp on it too long, and we'll just invite people to come to the forum and explain where I have missed something. But, you know, to me, this bit of it kind of undermined that scene from the first part of the finale, because it turns out the thing that they've all heroically volunteered to do in the name of friendship, they aren't alone in doing. Everyone's doing it, and everyone's doing it just because it's their job to do. So all of that speechifying was kind of for nothing, and it was kind of empty.
Or maybe those were the people that just didn't have to go because they were non-essential personnel, but they chose to anyway, or something explanation. Instead of answering your question, which I don't have an answer for, I'm going to go back to a couple things you skipped over that I really enjoyed. How about that?
It sounds awesome.
So I loved this scene where all of the people that are most important to making the suit and charging the time crystal and getting, you know, the main point of this plot going are moving down a hallway and get hit. I thought that the visual of it was really cool. We got this inside the ship visual, which we had gotten, I think, at least once before in the season with the turbo lift visuals. And the way it was done really wounded me, right? Like, to see just like this collection of some of the most important and most beloved by me people on this very important mission all just get slammed against the wall. This is one instance where I felt like the realism or the graphicness of the injuries portrayed in this particular scene, I thought was done to great effect. It wasn't gory, but it was realistic, and it made me really care about what was going to happen to the characters. And it was heartbreaking. I was not sure which one of them was going to get up.
I'm still not sure if Stamets is going to make it, right? It was a serious, serious wound. I wasn't sure he was going to even make it to sick bay. He will later. We'll talk about that scene. But gosh, I would not have been surprised if they got him to sick bay and he was dead on arrival. I mean, yeah, this was a harrowing scene. I really liked it.
I feel like if they kill Stamets, I'm going to rage quit this show. Like, if they kill the other gay character, I might lose it. So I really hope that doesn't happen. But yeah, that's how serious everything seemed. And there was a lot a lot riding on these characters making it through and being okay. And I really appreciated it. And then one other thing that I wanted just to like give a shout out and give a mention is the first of many things in this episode that is total fan service and connection to other past Trek. And I am not mad about it. I'm totally here for it. Is when Burnham asks Jet Reno to please charge the crystal faster. Like, you know, the engineer tells you how long it will take to do something. Somebody else says, hey, engineer, could you do it in half that time? And Jet Reno's sarcasm of being like, no, I cannot change the laws of physics. Please don't ask this. And Burnham's just like, okay. I thought that was a nice little shout out to all of the millions of times this has happened in other Trek. I love it when they tie Trek together like that.
I do too. And of course, this called to mind an episode that I watched very recently when we were preparing to go on the feast and talk about food and booze in Trek. And that's the TNG episode Relics, in which the TOS engineer, Scotty, shows up on Picard's Enterprise and gets to, maybe has to, hang out with Geordi a lot. And Scotty is trying to lecture Geordi about how to get a reputation as a miracle worker, which is to lie about how long something's going to take you. And then when you do it in less time, people think you're awesome. And Geordi's like, no, I just tell the captain how long it's going to take. He actually needs to have accurate information to make decisions.
Yeah, he still asks all the time for it to be cut in half. I mean, I think Scotty has a point.
Yeah, well, I'm with Scotty on this too, I will say. But Burnham maybe is in the Geordi camp on this one, and certainly Jet Reno is. Well, it is time now for the thing we have all been waiting for like five episodes. Burnham is going to put on this angel suit, this time travel suit. Spock is going to fly ahead of her in a shuttle, and this was not the plan that they agreed to, and Burnham is not happy about this decision at all.
I don't know. Like several of the things that happen in this episode, not all the dots get connected and the explanation isn't super effective, but I want Spock to do this and be there. I want more Spock, please. So I'm fine with it.
Yes, of course, we all realize immediately what's happening here is that we're separating Spock from the group so that he won't be able to get back to them and will not be going with them into the future. I don't want to jump the gun too much for our wrap-up episode, but I will say that I was at this point still not sure if we were going to end this episode really knowing where Spock was, or if it was going to be ambiguous so that Spock could be brought back in season three, if that was something that seemed like a good idea. But we'll get there eventually. Well, at this point, Burnham jumps into space just in this suit, and she's using its flight ability. So she's flying through space. The shuttles, the other small ships form a cocoon around her. This all looked really spectacular, and I was holding my breath while it was happening. And Poe is leading this squadron, this cocoon. Everyone else in these ships, though, is totally anonymous, as you pointed out already, Valerie. And of course, we do see several people die during this part of the battle. And it does seem to me that this is a place where we could have had our main characters doing something heroic by actually being the people piloting these ships or something, right? Like, if you want to have her 10 best friends volunteer for something, it's this. This is what they should have volunteered for, or construct some other dangerous thing for them to have done in this moment, something that matters to an immediate goal that is likely perilous.
Or even making the fact that Poe is leading this team more explicit, because it was very easy to miss that fact completely. I agree with you that the visuals of this were super cool. I loved Burnham like grazing the outside of the Enterprise. I do wonder, like, how much are they trying to just distract us with pretty things?
Yes, this flight trajectory does not make any sense. Don't fly into the path of your own phasers. There was probably some other direction they could have gone. In fact, there definitely was. I'm going to make fun of this a little bit, though. I accept that this is just the way we visually tell stories like this. They're only surrounded in the form of a circle, but space is three-dimensional. Just fly up.
Glenn, you told me we're not allowed to talk about space, because if you're going to make that comment, I'm going to talk about explosions in space, and it's not going to be good.
You're absolutely right. I take it back. I violated my own rule, which of course I do all the time flagrantly, but I will rein it in. Well, there's one more thing to say about this before we head to some of the other parts of the story. So when Burnham and Spock are clear of the battle and ready to open up the wormhole, it turns out that the temporal navigation computer is not working. It's not going to let Burnham travel into the future. And so this is a problem that we're going to have to solve after some side stories.
Yeah, you know, one thing I'm thinking about, I know we already kind of wrapped up that battle discussion, but something that was made apparent to me throughout the episode and in this flight scene in particular is, even if
the battle was hard to make heads or tails of, one thing that was incredibly clear is just the amount of Section 31 drones, ships, whatever, and how frequently they are firing. It is just like laser, 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 and, you know, photons, whatever. I'm calling them lasers. Just bombarded all the time, just never stopping. And that was a cool effect to see, you know, how intense the situation is. I was nervous.
Well, and it's about to get even more chaotic here, because at this point, some allies arrive to help out. And the first group of allies or first people we see, I guess, is a Klingon cleave ship. We see this decloak, and this was very cool looking. We have not seen one of these since the series premiere. I didn't realize we were calling them cleave ships, and I will remind you and listeners that cleave is my favorite auto antonym, so I'm quite happy about this. And of course, this is the secret mission that Tyler is on, and Laurel is on this ship as well.
We were talking earlier about the difference between space aircraft carriers and space submarines, and I think the introduction of this Klingon cleave ship was so cool, completely hit the mark on the whole ocean thing, because the super giant boat noises, for complete lack of a better term, that come along with the presence and decloaking of this ship were really cool for me.
I love these effects. I loved them when we saw this in the battle at the binary stars as well. I missed this. I'm glad that we're actually getting to see this. You know, I loved all of the Klingon decloaking that was happening in the first season. I think that's something that I definitely miss. And the noises are so great as well. Yeah, Klingons are cool. And I'm happy to see them here.
I mean, I did just watch the episode of Voyager where the Doctor has a family and his teenage son, you know, hangs out with the wrong crowd, which is Klingons. So, I mean, his dad's not wrong, but got to give him some respect.
Well, there's a reason that I have a Klingon tattoo and not a Romulan tattoo or a Borg tattoo.
Well, I'm about to have a Talosian tattoo, I think. That's what's up next for me. So what does this say about us?
Yeah, and you're not joking about that, too. And I'm very excited. I might have to start planning a new Trek tattoo for myself as well. I mean, I always plan to get a Romulan tattoo. I just never got around to it. Well, the Klingons are not the only allies who have shown up to this fight. They all show up at the same time. There are also some Ba'ul space fighter jets, and Saru's sister Sarana is piloting one of them. This I did not love. Everything about this is silly. And frankly, I found it kind of stupid, but they are here, so I'll embrace it. And I have a question about this, which is that Sarana addresses the people who are with her as warriors of Kaminar. And I wondered actually if she's the only Kelpian who's here. Are the rest of them Ba'ul, or are these all Kelpians? Or is this, in the 2 weeks since, everyone has gone post-Vahari and all of the society on Kaminar has been destabilized. Have they figured things out and created a sort of mixed species military together?
So I think it was sweet to see her here, and I get it. Brother-sister narratives, blah, blah, blah. I didn't love that we only got to see her through this weird window and then wearing like her hoodie the whole time. I don't know. I would have loved some more dimensions to the shots of her that we got, because I think she's a really lovely character. And I think the number one thing about her being here that isn't silly is that we get to see her say goodbye to Saru later on. And I don't think that's silly. I thought it was touching, and you can disagree with me about that later. Where I'm stuck is I'm not sure if only 2 weeks have passed. I'll take your word on that, Glenn. But yeah, I think that we are meant to believe that the Ba'ul and Kelpians are friends now. They have made an interspecies military, or at least they have for this one purpose. Maybe this is the thing that unified them. But I think that's what we're meant to believe, that this is a mixed species ship, and that Sarana has been the diplomat in charge of bringing these two parts of Kaminar together. And I think we're meant to see that as hopeful and lovely, not as, hey, wait, this doesn't make sense in terms of time, cynically, like you are.
Well, you're absolutely right. We're not supposed to be thinking about how much time has passed since that episode, or the fact that Saru only actually sent that letter, literally, I think we're told, 11 hours previously. if you sent me an email and said, can you please come to New York, I could do that, but it would still be about like 6 hours or so. And that's not traveling several light years. But yeah, so those were some of the things that I thought were silly and just undermined this for me. I do like that she's here, or at least that Saru is getting some kind of goodbye from her. I just feel like really it's kind of lazy to have settled on this as the way to do that rather than to have some other moment, of which, you know, there are several possibilities that the writers could have used.
Right. But what you're forgetting about is the fact that what happened on Kaminar and whether or not these species get along or are mortal enemies is actually not the point of anything that we saw happen on Kaminar. The point of going to Kaminar at all was for Serana to show up here later.
Yes, well, that's the part I am still quibbling with, though I think I have made my feelings about what happened on Kaminar quite well known, and we can revisit them in the next episode. So I'll move us along here and talk about what is actually happening here with Burnham and Spock. The arrival of Serana, as you say, Valerie, indicates to Spock that Burnham is the one who set the red signals that they've been following, and that she did all of this in order to gather up the elements that they would need to win this battle and get to the future. And on top of that, Spock postulates that because Burnham hasn't actually done this yet, and she hasn't gone back in time and made those signals yet, they are stuck in what he calls an open time loop. And if they close the loop, then they'll be able to take the suit to the future. And what he means by close the loop is that Burnham has to actually go make the signals. So she does. We get a montage of all of those scenes that we've seen before, but from Burnham's perspective this time. And it works. When she's done, she can set coordinates for Terralysium 930 years in the future. And this is all a big deal, right? This really resolves much of the obstacle here. And so we are ready to go, except for some other plots that we need to wrap up first.
While I didn't love the Burnham perspective montage sequences, I did love the visual of everything. It was like so cool, her traveling through time, especially the very first scene where she's kind of free-falling almost through time, and the little, for lack of a better term, like black hole things that get created. They look a little bit like those things in Roger Rabbit that get thrown on the ground. But I thought the whole visuals of all of this, I thought it was really, really, really impeccably done and super, super fun to watch.
Oh, the space stuff here, the traveling through time and space visuals were awesome. That black circle that she goes through, the way that black stood out against the black of space was awesome. I love when we see her only surrounded by that deep, deep shade of black. It felt cold and scary. It did actually make the time traveling that she's doing seem dangerous and terrifying. And that was something I really appreciated about this episode. I will say, of course, I've had Gene Wolfe on my mind this week. I mean, I always have Gene Wolfe on the mind, but especially this week. And Gene Wolfe's most famous work is about someone who wears a cloak that is a color so black, a shade so black, that it seems to actually devour all of the light around it. And the word that Wolf uses for this shade of black is fuligen. And I was completely reminded of that. I thought this is what Wolf was describing in the Book of the New Sun. It's this shade of black right here.
What's super cool about this is we actually have a new material that was recently, you know, brought into the world that is the darkest shade of black that looks just like this. It's called Vanta Black. And fun fact, it's made out of nanotubes. So it might be made out of Leland. We're not sure yet. But it is exactly like this. You put it over stuff and it looks like there's just like a giant hole there. It obscures it, like just no light can touch it.
And as soon as this is available in tattoo ink, I am getting a Gene Wolfe tattoo with that with that color black.
One other thing that we are skipping over in summarizing this really quickly is just the amazing on-screen relationship that is being shown between Spock and Burnham. The love, the tension, the fear, the worry, the burden, all of it is on both of their faces. And I think they make an impeccable team. It was really hard to lose them as a dyad at the end of this episode because I have just come to love them so much.
And we're going to have an opportunity to cry about this a lot in just a few scenes when we deal with their final words to each other, the sweet sorrow of their parting. And it did get to me, and I'm looking forward to talking about that. Before we do that, though, we should check in on Stamets, and then we've got to deal with another side plot or two as well. as I already said, I expected that Stamets was going to arrive here in sickbay already dead, but he's not. He is alive, though not in good shape, and Kolber is there to take care of him, though he is going to have to put Stamets into a coma because that's how serious his injuries are, and Stamets is not able to communicate here. But Kolber says that what they agreed on last episode was dumb, and he wants them to be together, and they're going to be.
I mean, Glenn, he says so much more than that.
Yeah, I try to essentialize the plot points.
Yeah, way to take one of my favorite scenes of the whole episode and pretend it didn't happen. I'm of two minds about this scene, as I am. I think that's the theme that's coming out with me for this season finale, is that I'm of two minds. So on the one hand, oh, I forgive you. I forgive you, writers, for giving me all this conflict and the will they, won't they, and the terrible conversations where they don't really communicate, because it all led to this beautiful, beautiful moment where I didn't think they were going to end up together, and they just might. So I loved that. That did work for me. It pulled me along, and I was on kind of an emotional roller coaster that, you know, if you look back on holistically, was maybe a little enjoyable. At the same time, I still don't love that these characters never really had a conversation where both of them are honest towards one another. We have Kolber, who was honest about his feelings towards several other people. Stamets does this as well. Maybe one of them says something to one person, but the other one's not telling the whole truth. And the conclusion of this is that Kolber finally comes clean when Stamets is literally incapacitated and cannot be a part of this conversation.
Yeah, I'm going to have more to say about this whole arc when we do the wrap-up episode next week, but I feel a little exhausted by all of this and the sort of really the directionlessness of it. I think that's a real problem for me that made me detached, I think, while watching this scene.
I think, you know, I'm still upset that Kolber, I think, didn't get all of the character development he could have had, and that this relationship didn't get the screen time that I think it deserved. But I am feeling hopeful, and I do think that this is important to say, even though it touches on some wrap-up stuff, I'm feeling hopeful that these two characters, you know, are going to be a part of the next season. And for me, given that they killed Kolber off at the end of last season, that feels really important to me. Though I am a little angry that maybe they're going to kill Stamets off at the end of this one. So look, just have them both be there in season three, and we're fine. We're going to be fine, guys, okay? We're going to be fine. Just all brush our teeth together and be nice.
Well, I'm going to resist the urge to speculate any further about this, though I'm super excited to do that next week. Let's talk about something else that's been going on while we've been dealing mostly with Burnham, which is that Enterprise has been struck by a photon torpedo that hasn't detonated, and this is the exact plot of Burnham's vision. We've seen this before. Number One and Admiral Cornwell go to disarm this torpedo and to seal it off in the event that they can't actually disarm it, and they discover, as of course they have to, that there's no way to disarm it, and it is going to blow up in just a few minutes. And that's going to be a disaster, but they can actually seal it off, but they can only do that from the inside of the room where it is. So someone is going to have to sacrifice herself. Someone's going to have to stay in the room or be trapped in the room when this goes off. And that someone is Admiral Cornwell, though Pike at this point comes down to offer himself and to offer even to just stay with her, to sacrifice both of them. But in the end, she orders him out of there. And in their conversation, it seemed to me that Cornwell knows about Pike's vision, and Pike even says here that he knows he won't die in this moment. So if he just stays, then the torpedo won't blow up. It can't blow up because of destiny. But Cornwell doesn't buy that. And I found this conversation about destiny and free will and choice here, as non-specific as it was, I found this really interesting.
I also, you know, one thing I was expecting you to say was that, like, how does it that Cornwell knows that about this vision? How come everybody seems to know about Pike's vision, but we never see that communicated? And the answer to that for me is that, you know, they be friends. They're hanging out. They're having some brandy.
Oh, I'm all about that. I don't disbelieve that. I just wasn't clear the first time we had that indicated that he had told people. Yeah, I think he's telling everybody about it, or he just like dropped his diary on the ground and I don't know, Burnham read it and told everybody.
Oh, that's amazing. Even before Pike gets there, we get this series of super cool scenes with Cornwell and Number One that is really just continuing on with this theme of cool, smart ladies doing stuff that really started at the end of season one, which was just ladies, ladies, ladies getting stuff done and is carried over into season two. Could have used more of it, but we get a lot of it in this two-parter finale with Poe and Tilly and now Number One and Cornwell.
Oh, yeah. When Cornwell and Number One got in that elevator to go down and deal with this problem and just like the serious business expression on their face. Yeah, that was awesome. They needed walk-on music, like sports walk-on music in that moment.
I know. I don't know why anyone else is on the ship. I feel like they can handle everything all by themselves. It's totally fine. But yeah, man, I have a lot of feelings about all of this. And I got to tell you, Glenn, there are other people I really would have rather died.
Same here. The whole time this is going on, I thought, well, it's going to have to be Number One, right? We've developed her as a character from the few bits of her we had in the original series. We're surely going to hear her named in this episode, and then she's going to die. I kind of predicted that even before we got to the episode. Then when we see her going into this room full of danger, it seemed so clear to me that that was going to be her arc. We're going to retire this character to have really kind of honored what Majel Barrett did and Gene Roddenberry's original vision for Star Trek and so on. But that's not what happened. And instead, we're getting rid of Cornwell, who I love and wish had more to do in this season. And it felt a little bit like, you know, the actor just needed to go on and do other things.
I don't know. I wonder if what they wanted was for there to be a loss. You know, I think it seems like the show wanted us to lose a major character, right? That line between major character, but not too major of a character. And so for that reason, I don't think they could have chosen Number One, because that wasn't what they wanted to elicit in us emotionally or from a storytelling perspective. So it might make more sense to lose a more minor character, but then you don't have this like dramatic, heartbreaking effect of it, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's completely what this scene is about. And in fact, this business with the torpedo is one of these things that I think is kind of artificially created or really contrived by the writers in this episode, because all of the actual action of the battle is happening with these smaller ships. And yeah, this is one of these moments where I wish that we'd actually had them really more engaged in the actual operations of the battle here, because I think some of Cornwell's sacrifice here was undermined a little bit by the way that it's divorced from the other action of the episode.
The story writers are probably not wrong in assuming that we, battle or no battle, we as viewers care deeply about what happens to the Enterprise, and this is a thing that could blow up the Enterprise. Now, the Enterprise has been blown up time and time again. There have been many versions. but, you know, I think that that's what they're playing with, is that it doesn't really matter what else is going on. We're still going to care about this ship because it is the ship, even though this show is about an entirely different ship.
Cornwell is not the only loss that we are going to feel in this episode, although she is the biggest character death. Burnham is just about ready to go to the future, but Spock's shuttle is broken, and so he can't fly back to Discovery and come with her. And this is upsetting to Burnham. She wanted Spock to be able to join her in the future. She wanted them to be together. She says, "I don't want to lose you again." And here is where Spock makes a speech about how she never lost him, and how he feels that if it hadn't been for her, he would never have learned how to be himself, never learned how to navigate between his father's identity and his mother's identity, and her presence in his life, her becoming a part of his family, saved him. She saved him, is what he says. And this is all really touching, really heartbreaking. This was a great speech.
What was particularly effective for me about it wasn't the profound emotion that Burnham was showing, because I think we all know Burnham can show a lot of profound emotion, and Sinequa Martin-Green is a fantastic actress. But Spock was so emotional here in such a Spock way, still contained, still a little robotic, still with great posture the entire time. But whoa, like the effect of what a very constricted, logical-minded character might be like if he were trying not to cry was just acted perfectly by Ethan Beck.
It was so good. And it's great. This scene wraps up everything that we had from Child Spock. It really sews up, ties together this arc that we had for Spock in this season. And in some ways, this is perhaps the last moment of Spock's childhood or Spock's youth or something like this. And now he's going to go off and be the character we know from the original series.
Right. And of course, I cannot wait to talk about the scene at the end of the episode that ties everything you just said together.
Yes, we are going to get this visually at the end. And it's awesome. I'll say it again with more feeling when we get there. But it is awesome. But before she goes, Burnham has some final advice for Spock. She tells him not to isolate himself. She tells him more or less to find meaningful relationships. And I have to think that the writers here have in mind Kirk and Bones, right? That the writers are looking ahead to the future of Spock here as well, and seeing the closest friendships that he ever has as growing out of things he learned from Burnham.
I had the same question in my mind of whether or not Kirk was the one that was being thought of here. I think it's fair to say that it is Kirk who we're kind of not talking about. I was a little confused by Burnham's advice. So I don't know, Glenn, can you help me out? This idea of finding the person that seems farthest for you and reaching for them and letting them reach for you. I mean, I don't know if it was just supposed to be a thing about how Spock and Kirk are very different personality types and yet they have this lovely friendship, or if they're just, you know, referencing how much the internet really loves to ship these characters, because it did seem a little steamy when she was talking about it. I don't know. I didn't really get the advice. Did you?
Yeah, I had to parse it out a lot. I mean, I had to watch it several times and, you know, with the subtitles on as well. It's not the most articulate thing. And I guess that's one of the things that points to Kirk here, is that the writers are kind of trying to talk about Kirk without talking about Kirk. But, you know, my sense was that what she was saying was, don't be alone. Don't isolate yourself. Find meaningful relationships. And in particular, find meaningful relationships with people who are different from you, people who will not let you retreat into yourself, right? People who will force you to be the person that you actually want to be, I guess, maybe force you to be as much like Amanda as you are like Sarek. And, you know, I suppose that is one way of thinking about Kirk as, and Bones as well, as people who are always trying to get Spock to have emotions, trying to make jokes with him, and in some ways loving Spock whether he wants it or not. That was how I made sense of this.
Well, first of all, I don't think Kirk and Bones are ever making jokes with Spock. They are making them at him. And TOS is really mean to Spock.
Yes, I was trying to be polite.
Yeah, he's like the butt of every joke. It's really not okay. It borders on bullying, even though they all clearly love one another. And, you know, I think that explanation is helpful. This idea that, like, reach for people who won't let you retreat into yourself. I can get behind that. That makes me think of T'Pol, even, right? And her own character development and other Vulcans. So I like that. I wish it had been written the way you said it, not the way it actually was. I was trying to figure out if it was some sort of comment on our current political climate about, like, reaching across the aisle and not being so divided from one another. I don't know, man. Usually the speech I give is like, find the people that love you and love them back, not find the people impossibly far away from you and try to get them to like you or something. So the way it was worded did not totally work for me. I also think that pointing to Kirk, yeah, okay, whatever, we love Kirk, we know Kirk, but it glosses over that Spock has already created this kind of relationship with Pike. And obviously that relationship is meaningful enough that, you know, he risks his entire career to give Pike a nice life on Talos IV. So I don't know, man. I don't know. This one was hard for me. I loved the scene. I loved the brother sister dynamic. The acting was impeccable. You're right that it ties up the entire storyline. It's the conclusion of Spock's childhood in a lot of ways. Enjoyed all of that. Did not totally enjoy this piece of advice.
Agreed. It's a weak part of this scene. Well, we need to backtrack actually quite a bit again. In fact, listeners might be shaking their fists in the air at the fact that I have glossed over a whole plot line that's actually been happening in very small chunks throughout the episode so far. When Burnham and Spock left Discovery, the ship had to lower part of its shield so they could get out. And in that brief moment, Leland was able to beam over, and he's been running around Discovery for a little while now. So he shoots up the place, just like we saw in Burnham's vision. But then he goes in search of the sphere data. And Giorgio and Nan give chase to him, and they're both creepily excited about torturing him, so that's great, I guess. And there's a lot of fighting along the way, but it culminates in Giorgio trapping Leland in the spore drive, which is something that we'll get back to in a minute. But what I want to talk about here, I think what mattered to me and was very confusing, very jarring to me in the episode, is that Leland is on Discovery. Control, right now, is on Discovery, even as they are seconds away from traveling to the future, which they are doing to hide from Control. But no one seems to think this is a problem. No one is saying, hey, we really can't jump until we get Leland off the ship or anything like that. It's almost a totally isolated plot that no one else cares about and that doesn't have any consequences, even though it's the most consequential thing that's actually happening in this episode. It was very strange storytelling to me, and it really sucked me out of the episode.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's a really excellent point. Somebody should have said that. That should have been raised. I think it speaks volumes that I didn't notice. And I said earlier that the show seems to be distracting us with the aesthetics. I think there's a lot of distraction happening in this finale, distracting with how pretty everything looks, distracting with how much we love Burnham and Spock, distracting with the fast pace of everything, distracting with the jumping between different plot points, which you, Glenn, have done an excellent job of separating out in this recap. And it kind of just leaves it feeling like the whole Leland thing is like a thing we have to take care of because we spent all season setting it up. But really, it's just the fight scene we're going to have. We need to have a choreographed fight scene because we've had lots of those this season. And here's this one. And to be fair, I liked that gravity problem fight scene. It was really cool to watch, but it didn't feel meaningful. It just felt nice to watch.
I certainly marveled at how they did that technically. It looked really good. It also looked like it took a long time to film. Actually, the whole episode looked like it took a long time to film. Something else that was strange to me, though, about the way that this Leland story is being handled is that the writers do decide that something should be going wrong on Discovery at the last minute that has to be fixed before they can jump. Why Leland is not being emphasized as that thing when Leland is very clearly actually that thing, I'm not sure. That's mystifying to me. But the thing that they come up with, the thing that Discovery has to do before they can go through this wormhole is fix their shields. Right now, they are not strong enough to handle the time stuff. And so Tilly has been dispatched to take care of this. And the MacGuffin thing that she has to fix is in the Jeffries tube. So we get an actual Jeffries tube scene here. And as she pulls this off, she leans back and says, "Somebody owes me a beer." This is hands down my favorite moment of the episode. And, you know, it also feels like a metaphor for my entire life.
Yeah. And man, almost more heartbreaking than like anything else in this episode, including Cornwall's death. And it's hard. I'm sad to lose her. But the scene was so dignified in a way that it didn't get my heartstrings as much was when Tilly walks away from Stamets. Tilly having to walk away from Stamets and the emotion that Mary Wiseman pours into this moment so that she can go do the shield thing to save all the stuff. Oh, man, did that get me. I thought this was a really cool setup of a conflict between family and love and duty to Starfleet and to this thing you signed up for. And I think they've been trying to hit this beat of duty and loyalty to the service a lot of times this season. And this one was particularly effective for me.
I think this was the only attempt here that landed for me on this beat this whole season.
You know, Glenn, you mentioned that two things that are worth picking up. One is that your favorite line, that is the story of your life, is "Someone owes me a beer." You also mentioned that Nan and Giorgio are creepily into torturing and murdering Leland Bot. You said it was fine. I disagree. I think it was horrible. I don't understand it at all and didn't think it was fun. And that brings me to probably one of my least favorite lines in Star Trek of all time, which was "yum, yum."
Yeah, let me be clear. I was being sarcastic when I said it was fine. It was not fine. And I could not believe that it was greeted with "yum, yum." Trek has had to deal with the question of torture before. I mean, the whole third season of Enterprise is a response to 9/11 and a response to our response to 9/11. And how torture became something that the American military and intelligence services, of which I was a part, were comfortable doing, and whether or not we wanted to be people who did that. Enterprise handled this quite well, where it is not where it is a difficult choice, where one is having to weigh the pros and cons of torturing someone in order to get information to save other people. Here it's a joke. It's a joke. And it's disgusting.
I mean, especially the way that bad, secret, torturous things are also handled in Deep Space Nine. You know, people blur a lot of lines on that show, but they're very aware of it and reflect on it with a seriousness, not a yum-yum. I literally out loud was like, who let that line happen? And I think it's part of this injection of this vein of Section 31 gimmicky villains that we get in season two. And what didn't really make sense for me in this episode in particular was, okay, fine, we've become accustomed to that being Georgiou, but why is it Nan? Why is it the Starfleet security officer? Why do we have, you know, not that long ago, Pike giving this beautiful speech about all of these amazing, wonderful, idealistic, optimistic views and values that are at the core of Starfleet, and then we have a security officer saying yum yum to torture? It just didn't make sense to me. And I gotta tell you, in case it's not clear, still don't like Nan.
She's a huge puzzle. She's a security person on the show right now. When we met her, she was an engineer. She's been a security person for like 2 months or something. So it's not even like so it's not even like we can really buy into the thing that Star Trek does like to do, which is to make all security people extremely paranoid and Worf famously, classically, always ready to blow up everything. It's like his first response. Nan is an engineer. She should want to build things as her first response, not destroy them. Yeah, none of this makes any sense. Her character is very confusing. I can't believe this line made it on the air. I was deeply disturbed by this actually last night. In fact, lost quite a bit of sleep over thinking about what this line means for who we have become as a people, that in the last... That somehow we have wandered away from all of the anxiety that we had about this just 18 years ago, 15 years ago, that we're back to thinking torture can be funny. And maybe that's something we can think about a little bit more in the wrap-up episode. It's something certainly I would love to talk with people about on the forums as well. So please come engage with us on this topic, on this line over there. But at this point, we are just about done with this part of the episode before we get into our epilogues, our codas. Georgiou uses magnets to destroy Leland in the spore drive. This is the second time that magnets have played a crucial plot role this season. So Alex Kurtzman must own stock in a magnet company or something. Right?
You would think that after the last time, Control would have solved this whole magnets can very easily destroy me problem.
Yeah, right. Magnets have just been all over this season. It's very strange. But as Leland is destroyed, the Section 31 ships all shut down because they were being controlled by him. He's the White Walker of Control, I guess. and with this done, Burnham and Discovery go to the future. And the time effect inside of Discovery while they're jumping here is super close to what we see in Star Trek IV, just without the white chocolate pudding heads. And I absolutely love this. I love this, but I wish they had gone all the way with it. I wanted to see these floaty head things. That's like one of my favorite effects from that movie.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people don't agree with you. And, you know, you made this comparison to being the White Walker. I think we're missing an Independence Day comparison here where he's like the mothership.
Yes, that's actually probably the more apt comparison. But of course, we're all watching Game of Thrones right now, too.
Before we conclude this episode, I do think we need to go back for a second and say a little bit more about Tyler and Laurel, other than they're here. and they don't get a lot of screen time in this episode, so it's very easy to ignore them in one way. But in another way, it's so hard to ignore them because, man, are they shouting how good of a day it is to die in Klingon. And, man, did I enjoy it. And I think the rest of the internet is with me on this one.
And you were lamenting earlier that it never really felt like Pike was in any particular danger in this battle, which I think is true. But Laurel is. She actually, when their ship gets shot, she actually gets wounded. She's bleeding on her head. And she thinks this is awesome. She's super happy about this. And Tyler kind of is too, in some way, right? This is the thing about Klingons, is they kind of like getting punched in the face.
I loved it. I just love how tough she is. And she is a Klingon through and through. It was so enjoyable. And it was a nice little break, right? I don't want to glorify battle, but it was a little bit of relief from the denseness of the rest of the episode to see the Klingons enjoying themselves in this fight rather than worried about everything that was going to happen. And again, just like the Klingon, like the how it sounds, how great of a job these actors do with their Klingon is just so, so fun. I was a little bit sad that the bridge crew of the Klingon ship did not break out in song. That would have been really fun for me. But I have a question for you, Glenn. It feels like a pretty important question. Don't all Klingons, including the ones on the bridge of the ship, think Tyler is dead and that's the only reason they were able to unify?
Well, that's an excellent point. Yes, they're... We have been pointing out, I think, some real flaws in much of the plotting and even something like this, which is not just plotting, but even world building. Throughout this episode, this is another one of them. You're dead on. You're absolutely right. This should not be happening. Or, you know, we should at least see something of the consequences of this later.
I mean, the guy on the bridge is like, yes, my chancellor, my mother chancellor, right? And he wouldn't be doing that. The only reason that he is calling her that he is behind her, is because she murdered the guy standing next to her on the bridge right now. This one was rough. I loved Laurel and Tyler, you know, charging into battle together and shouting it's a good day to die and all this fun Klingon stuff. But I could not get past the part where... him being alive ruins literally everything.
Right. How hard would it have been for him to actually be in some kind of disguise or something on the bridge where, you know, we, the audience, can still know that Tyler is there, but the characters on the bridge don't know that that's him, don't recognize him. I don't think that would have been so difficult to do. This just feels like a mistake. It just feels like the writers have forgotten their own plots, their own the world that they have constructed. There's a lot of this type of sloppiness this season, I think, that we didn't see in the first season. And yeah, I had pretty negative reaction to much of it. I'm glad you noticed this one as well. Well, and there's more going on with Tyler. I think, you know, Tyler, as we have talked about, has been a sort of bizarre character this season. So we get these two epilogues at the end, and the first is at Starfleet headquarters in San Francisco, where Starfleet Command is debriefing Pike, Spock, Tyler as well, and then also Number One. Number One almost gets a name here, but she doesn't. I'm not sure if I like this move or not. I get that this could be about wanting to preserve this name for the character that's played by Majel Barrett, Gene Roddenberry's wife, you know, beloved by all of us, to continue to honor her. But as one of our listeners suggested on the forum, why not just call her Commander Barrett? And I think I would be all in favor of that.
That would be really cool. That would be such a tribute and tie everything together in a super fun way.
Yeah, and this is all set up as a joke here, where we're seeing all the other characters give their names, and then she just says Number One. But I thought we were gonna get Barrett as her name. I'm a little disappointed that we didn't, but I, you know, it's neither here nor there, I suppose.
Maybe they were trying to connect us to the tension with the Doctor on Voyager never getting a name.
Yeah, fair enough. Maybe we should have a contest to name that character, though my money is on Barrett for sure. Well, all of these characters who are being debriefed here, they all say that Discovery was destroyed while attempting to spore jump out of this battle. And of course, they tell this lie so that Starfleet records will show that the sphere data was destroyed. And this is just in case control is not really gone, right? This is all about protecting Burnham and Discovery, who've gone off, you know, 900 years into the future. And speaking of control, Starfleet assures Tyler that control is definitely, totally, 100% destroyed, so don't worry about that. And of course, Section 31 also needs more oversight, and so Tyler is promoted to commander. Commander as a rank here. This is like a 27 rank promotion for Tyler, so again, crazy stuff happening with Tyler here. Like, Tyler's rank was like slightly above janitor. He's a specialist. That's a rank I held in the army, so I don't mean to denigrate people who are specialists. I have been a specialist. It is a low rank. You don't jump this far ahead normally. But I will also say that I have never fully understood Section 31's org chart. I've never understood Leland's place in it. But are we to understand that Tyler is actually going to be in charge of Section 31? Is he like the boss of it, or is he just like one commander in it?
I was so confused by all of this. I could tell what they were trying to do, right? They did so many things to tie up the loose ends of like, how come we've never heard of Burnham before ever? How come, you know, we've never heard of a spore drive before ever, right? They're tying all that up in a neat little bow here for us. But I really expected them to explain what happens to Section 31. I was expecting a clear statement of no more Section 31, guys. Okay, we're done. Doesn't exist. No more. And then that sets us up for, you know, the rest of Trek as we know it. But the way that it was framed here was extremely ambiguous. There were a couple lines that made it seem like Section 31 is a no-go, but also that Tyler's in charge of it all. And I think this is going to be part of a larger discussion next week on who is and isn't on Discovery, who is and isn't in the future, who is and isn't coming to season 3. But I was a little confused by the whole, pretty sure Georgiou's on Discovery in the future, and I'm also pretty sure Georgiou's supposed to be on the Section 31 show. So that left me puzzled.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week. We've got one more thing to do here in this epilogue, which is to deal with Spock. Spock suggests that Starfleet should classify all the data about Discovery, about Discovery's crew, also the time suit, and make it treasonous for anyone to talk about any of that classified information, including even the existence of Michael Burnham. And we're going to get more on this in the next and final scene of the season. So this second epilogue that we get, this comes 4 months later. Enterprise is repaired, but the seventh signal still hasn't appeared. And this is something that Burnham said she was going to use in order to let Spock know that she was safe, that she'd made it to the future all right. And Spock is actually dictating a letter to Burnham. It's really all the Spock voiceover. And he says that even though the signal hasn't appeared, he chooses to believe that she made it safely. And he also says that he and their parents have agreed to never speak her name to anyone so as to keep her safe in the future. And of course, this and the whole treason business is meant to please people who were annoyed that the Discovery writers gave Spock a sister. I was never one of those people. I didn't need this conclusion. I didn't need this wrapped up. But I understand that some people did, and I hope this worked for them.
Boy, do I have a question about personal logs, because he is saying in his personal log his sister's name and stuff that's all about her being in the future, when he's also saying he's not allowed to say any of those things under penalty of treason.
Right. And it's not that hard to access a personal log, as we have seen. And even if you delete your personal log entry at the end, it's not permanently gone. I can get right to that with my basic computer skills.
Yeah, this season opens with Burnham just walking straight into Spock's room and listening to all of his personal logs. I don't get it. I don't understand personal logs or why Spock would put this in one. I get that, you know, narrating logs is how we tell stories in Trek. This was just a confusing contradiction for me.
Well, I have already written a note to Captain Pike to suggest that Spock might need some remedial training on operational security. So he'll get better in the future, I'm sure.
Really, all I care about is shaving the beard. Shaving the beard.
Yes, though we don't actually see him do any shaving, which I don't know, maybe is disappointing for some people. But yes, we get the TOS theme playing in the background, swelling in the background, really, as Spock returns to the Enterprise Bridge in uniform and without his beard. And wow, he looked a lot like a young Leonard Nimoy. I was moved. I was not prepared for the feelings.
I completely agree. I'm actually like upset that they hid this from me all season, because when you look at bearded, out of uniform Spock, he doesn't look anything like Spock. And it's confusing and it's hard to connect with him. But oh my God, did my heart skip so many beats. I wanted to cry. I was so happy and touched, and I was having every emotion. He looks so great, and he really did look like Spock. And I think now we know the answer. Why wasn't he in the uniform all season? Why did he have this weird beard? Why is he stuck in that leather outfit that makes no sense even though he's on duty? It's so that this could happen to dramatic effect.
And it was absolutely the right choice. If he had looked like this the first time that we saw him, we all would have been critiquing and we would have been almost on guard, actually, feeling protective, maybe, of our love for Leonard Nimoy. And here, instead of that, it feeling like maybe that's being attacked somehow by Discovery, under assault in some way, that Leonard Nimoy's memory being tarnished, because they have flipped it around, flipped this revelation around, this feels like the best way to honor Leonard Nimoy and to celebrate his memory and everything that we cherish about him. I have to applaud the showrunners for making this choice. They nailed this. Well, this is not the absolute end, because just as he gets on the bridge, as Spock arrives here, the Seventh Signal appears at Terra Elysium. So everything has worked out. And now Enterprise is off to continue their mission of exploration. And the first stop is going to be a newly discovered moon around Edryn 2. Pike tells the helm to hit it one last time. Enterprise warps away and the season is over. That's the end of it all.
Ugh, I'm sorry, Glenn. I stopped paying attention because I was just replaying the scene where Spock shows up without his beard over and over again in my head. I think it's going to be what I fall asleep to every night now. It was just, wow, how wonderful. Yeah, man, what a crazy cliffhanger. I don't know what to do with myself. They really got me. And I'm going to have to wait a long time to figure out what is going on with literally everything.
Yes, yes, we are all feeling this way, and it is a cliffhanger, and of course, I think we're going to have to leave listeners on a bit of a cliffhanger, at least for hearing our thoughts and our speculations about what's in store for the future. Hopes and dreams, maybe we should say as well, for next week when we do our wrap-up episode. But we still have a little more business to do in this episode, which is to use some booze to say farewell to Admiral Cornwell.
It better have scotch in it.
Oh, it absolutely has scotch. It is, in fact, mostly just a shot of scotch, a double shot of scotch. So, yeah, we are gonna toast the sacrifice of Admiral Cornwell, a character who I have just immensely enjoyed since the first moment that she came on screen. I have loved the way that she interacted with Lorca, that she didn't take any of his crap the way that everyone else had to. I liked that she was a counselor who had gone on and become a part of the Starfleet brass. She was a real hero. She was one of the few people who was instrumental in winning the Klingon War. And here she is again in this season, putting her whole career and her life on the line to defeat Section 31, to defeat control, to defeat this crazy AI from the future. And she does give her life for that. So she needs to be honored here at the end of this episode. So we've got a shot for her. It is an ounce and a half of scotch. I used Johnny Walker Red, but you could really use anything that you want. I mean, it was a nicer bottle of scotch than that she and Lorca had the last time they were together. And I want to sweeten this up just a little bit with a half ounce of maraschino liqueur. One of the things I do like about Johnny Walker Red Label scotch is that it has a kind of soft cinnamon flavor to it that actually plays quite well with the cherry liqueur. But then we are going to toughen this up again by using some Hellfire bitters. That's a trademark type of bitters. You can use any type of spicy bitters, a habanero bitters, a jalapeno bitters, whatever you want. You could even just use Tabasco sauce or something if you like, but just something that's going to give it a little bit of kick on the back end. So you'll get the scotch, get a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of cherry, and then you will get this fire. And I think that does a good job of encapsulating Cornwell, and downing this as a shot all in one go is a nice farewell to our comrade who has given her life to save us all.
That beautifully encapsulates her character and her personality, except for the part where I don't know how pleasant the experience of drinking this would be, but I found the experience of Cornwell quite pleasant.
Well, we are actually going to have a live team up next week when we record our wrap up episode in person, in the same room, everybody in Clay Temple headquarters. So perhaps we'll have a few farewell Cornwell shots before we get on the air and do that episode.
Right. And what we're going to be doing together in that room is doing our season 2 wrap up, speculating about what season 3 is going to be, and probably most importantly, giving out some awards, giving out some Glennies and some Valeries like we did at the end of season 1. So please, listeners, if you have award categories that you want us to vote on or make decisions about, come to the forums and let us know what those are. We will do our best to include them in the show.
Yes, and no category is too ridiculous. And we're also going to do some serious things. Then we're going to take a look at the themes and motifs of the season. We'll look at the character arcs and see whether they worked or not, really kind of dissect the season as a whole as a single story. I'm really looking forward to that episode. But until we get there, that's going to do it for this one. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and you can find us and our other creative projects, as always, at claytemplemedia.com. And if you're as excited about the Picard show airing this fall as we are, please consider supporting us so that we can cover it for you. We would love to take that journey alongside you.
Coming over to the Clay Temple forums and let us know what you thought of this finale. And as I said at the top of the show, this week is a great time to go read a Gene Wolfe story. We have a forum for Gene Wolfe as well. Come let us know what you think of the story you check out.
And until the Johnny Walker Red runs out, stay spacey.